Dr. Vandana Nayyar, welcome to Amicroscopio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about nephrolithiasis and what are the physiopathological mechanisms related to nephrolithiasis, and can we differentiate the causes in the laboratory? Could you please tell us about the treatment? Is treatment different in each case type of nephrolithiasis?
Absolutely. So, nephrolithiasis, as you know, it originates from two Greek words. Nephros is the kidney, and lithos means stones. So basically, it's a scientific term for kidney stones. And the main pathophysiological mechanism that is responsible or related to nephrolithiasis is the supersaturation of urine. So going back to, you know, high school days, we know that there is only a maximum that the amount of a compound can be kept in a stable solution, and that is defined by its solubility. So when the amount of this compound in a solution exceeds the solubility, that's supersaturation. At that point, there is a process that will begin to remove this excess by crystal formation. And this is the basic underlying pathophysiological mechanism for the formation of kidney stones, that the urine gets supersaturated with salts, like either calcium oxalate, which may lead to calcium stones, sodium urate, which may lead to uric acid stones, magnesium ammonium phosphate, which leads to the struvite stones that are commonly seen with upper urinary tract infections, or cysteine, which leads to cysteine stones. So when you consider this pathophysiology, physiological mechanism, definitely we can determine the causes in the lab, because there are these, you know, there are many different kinds of stones, but the main are these four kinds of stones. And usually what you need to do is what's called a stone analysis. So the patients can send in either their kidney stone to some commercial laboratory, and stone analysis can be done either on the stone itself, or we can have the patient collect their urine for 24 hours. And once we get these results in the lab, we can actually figure out what kind of stone the patient has. And based on the kind of stone, the treatment or the therapy can be tailored. Now, you asked me about the treatment. I kind of look at treatment of kidney stones as two different parts. So one, you actually have a kidney stone and you need to treat or dissolve that current stone, which are a lot of the surgical techniques that are used by urologists. But the second part is just as important. You want to prevent future stone formation. Any patient who's had a kidney stone knows how painful that is. And one without the other is incomplete. So both of these are integral components of the therapy. And in fact, in 95% of the patients, we can actually have or detect a treatable metabolic etiology. So obviously the key thing to remember is that medical therapy, it prevents new stone formation, but it doesn't dissolve the pre-existing stones. For those, we have therapies like, you know, ureteroscopy, where you pass something up through the ureter and you can actually, most commonly in the lower one-third of the urinary tract, or you can do extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsy, where you use shockwaves to break up the stone, or you can end up doing open procedures. That is the surgical component, and then, like I said, the medical component is important just as well, and it's different for different kinds of stones. The one thing that's common to all patients with stone disease is having a high fluid intake so that you have a urinary output of at least 2 liters a day. But if it's a calcium stone and you have hypercalciuria, that means you're excreting a lot of calcium in the urine, you can use things like thiazide diuretics. If the patient has low citrate, or if the patient has uric acid stones, if the urine is persistently acidic, you can use things like potassium citrate. So again, therapy can be tailored to the kind of stone, and it is, you know, basic principles are the same, but there are some differences based on the type of stone that you have.
How do nephrolithiasis and gouty diathesis differ, and what is the significance of the role of hyperuricosuria and urinary pH on stone formation? Is one more causative than the other? And what is the urine pH we should aim for, and how do we achieve that? And if the presence of hyperuricosuria related to a diet? Is it beneficial to follow a special diet?
Right. Okay, so yes, all of these are slightly different. So hyperuricosuria is basically the fact that 24-hour uric acid excretion is high. And the numbers are slightly different for men or women, higher than 750 milligrams in women and 800 milligrams in men. And you're right, the diet does have an important part to play because the most common cause of hyperuricosuria is an increase in your dietary purine intake. And purines are compounds that are found in high concentration in meat and meat products. So basically, if you are at risk for hyperuricosuria and for the formation of stones, you really need to be on a plant-based diet, which is low in purines. Now, on the other hand, gouty diathesis is basically the formation of urinary stones in people who actually already have gout. So people who have primary gout, when they get kidney stones as a result of their gout, that is gouty diathesis. So there you actually have a specific mechanism that is causing the stones. And the patients may also present with other manifestations of gout, for example, gouty arthritis. And hyperuricemia is another factor, which is the amount, so like we talked about in blood and in urine, so hyperuricemia is a high level of uric acid in the serum or in the blood. And we have seen that patients, the higher the serum uric acid, the higher the risk of gout. However, there are patients who have asymptomatic hyperuricemia, which means that they don't have the symptoms, but they have high levels of uric acid. These people, we don't prophylactically put them on therapy, but these people are at higher risk for developing stones. And the questions that you asked about uric acid concentration and an acidic pH, the more important out of these two is actually the acidic urine pH, which if you, again, going back to our science days, if you look at the equation where a positive hydrogen ion combines with a urate ion, which is negative, it forms uric acid. The urate is soluble. It is when it gets converted to uric acid during when the urine has a urinary acidic pH, that is when you run the risk of having, when we talked about the supersaturation, the solubility falls and this uric acid precipitates out in the form of crystals, which then form the basis for the stones. So patients with uric acid nephrolithiasis, the key component along with increasing your fluid intake is actually alkalinization of the urine. And again, you can do that with giving them a potassium citrate.
And what is the relationship between uric acid levels and renal disease? What is the origin? And is it related to cardiovascular risk? What is the predictive value in uric acid levels of renal disease?
Right, and so that is actually the hot topic in nephrology these days, is the fact that there is possibly a mechanism that uric acid levels, not the basic ones that we all know, that 70% of the uric acid is excreted by the kidney. So it makes sense that as your kidney function will decline, there will be a decreased excretion of uric acid, and therefore you'll have hyperuricemia because you're just not getting rid of the uric acid. But that is not the only relationship that we see between hyperuricemia, gout, and kidney disease. And in recent years, this is even more important as we are seeing that the prevalence of both gout and chronic kidney disease is increasing. And one factor that people have been talking about a lot is the fact that many studies, especially in labs, have shown that when you have an elevated serum uric acid level, it independently predicts the development of chronic kidney disease. And initially, many years ago, early in the mid-19th century, we thought that that was due to the development of crystals. But as more time has passed and as we've done more research, we found that when you raise the uric acid level in rats, it actually induces glomerular hypertension and renal disease. And you can see that because when you do these specimens, you can see arteriosclerosis, glomerular injury, and tuber interstitial fibrosis. So interestingly, pilot studies have shown that when you lower these uric acid concentrations, you actually may slow the progression of renal disease. And so while we still need further clinical trials, uric acid is emerging as a potentially modifiable risk factor for CKD. So that is absolutely new research and very interesting, and something we can actually do about the link. Now, as regards cardiovascular disease, there is definitely a concern that if you compare gout to another rheumatological disease like rheumatoid arthritis, that rheumatoid arthritis, gout, chronic kidney disease, the one thing that's common to all of them is a chronic, low-grade, systemic inflammatory response. And this response is actually central to the accelerated atherogenesis and a high rate of cardiovascular disease that's present in all these conditions. Now, definitive studies are not there yet for us to definitely link high uric acid levels, chronic kidney disease, and cardiovascular risk, but we do know that mortality is higher in these patients, and we think one unifying hypothesis may be this low-grade systemic inflammation that's present in all of these. So definitely this is an area of great concern in these patients. And interestingly, there has been, you talked about the predictive values of uric acid in renal disease. There has been one recent study which followed over 3,000 patients for a period of 5 years. The study came out of Taiwan, and what they found was that patients who had persistently high levels of uric acid did end up developing a new onset chronic kidney disease over a longitudinal period of time. So again, definitely associative studies, but nothing definitive, but an area of increased concern within the renal as well as the rheumatological population.
What is the prevalence of gout in the world? Are there differences between sex and age? And is crystalluria a positive predictor of a disease?
Yeah, so gout, the prevalence is increasing steadily worldwide, and especially in the United States. Globally, if you were to put the entire world's population, the prevalence is over 1%. But in the United States, where I practice, it's estimated that around 4% of the adult population has gout. Now, there are some, like the Oceania countries, the native New Zealanders, they have an extremely high prevalence of gout. It varies widely, but the one key factor is throughout the world, the incidence and the prevalence of gout is increasing. And gout is now the most common type of inflammatory arthropathy. As far as differences between sex and age, men do have a higher prevalence, 3 to 6 times higher prevalence than women. But after 70 years of age, the difference between men and women is less prevalent. And this is because, less prominent, because this reflects the fact that younger women don't really get gout, but as they increase in age and they become postmenopausal, their risk almost equals that of men. Now, going back to crystalluria, so crystalluria is the presence of crystals in the urine. This may suggest, but it's not definitely predictive of stone formation. This is because we go back to that concept that we discussed earlier, which is supersaturation. So you may have crystals in the urine, and that is because you have reached this maximum solubility concentration. However, so it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a kidney stone, though again, you're at high risk for it. However, if you have a patient who has clinical symptoms that suggest gout, we can definitely diagnose gout if you find these crystals when you aspirate from a joint or a tophus. And these crystals, these monosodium urate crystals, can be easily seen by polarized light microscopy. They are needle-shaped, they have a negative sign of birefringence, and they are large, long crystals. And so if you have the crystals during an acute attack from a joint or a tophus, that has the highest diagnostic value for gout. But if you have crystals in the urine, you do know that the patient is at risk because they've already exceeded their supersaturation, but not necessarily diagnostic of having a kidney stone. So two different diseases.
Dr. Niyar, would you like to make any final comment?
Thank you very much for inviting me for this. And this is a topic that's dear to my heart and definitely an area of growing concern within the community, especially with the risk of hyperuricemia, chronic kidney disease, and its effect on cardiovascular disease, especially as we see an increasing prevalence in all these diseases globally. I feel that in the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to get answers and hopefully be able to modify some of our risk factors. So I appreciate your time and inviting me to speak for this.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have you in Microscopio.
Thank you.